Okay, members, calling the meeting to order. Today is Monday. Get this so you can hear me. Today is Monday, February 10th, and at this, at 1 o'clock on PM. We are going to begin our health and finance policy hearing. As a reminder to all members and the public, there are no signs, outbursts, or clapping. Those in attendance must be seated and at their chair, clear the aisles and walkways. In accommodation, if there needs to be additional communications, of course, we have sergeant staff here. Those who disrupt the committee business will be escorted out of the committee room. Members of the public should not approach committee members at the table. For now, we do have one non-voting member on the committee. That's Representative Keeler. Representative Keeler is welcome to participate in the discussion, but won't be able to offer any amendments or voting on bills and not counted towards quorum. I guess you got the straw there, Representative Keeler. And I do not know how that was determined. So what we want to do, first of all, is to do members and staff introduction. And we are going to start down there with Representative Carroll. You will start there. We'll go on the outside, and then we'll come in the inside. So
I'm impressed that you know who I am.
Well, I have Vice Chair Nadeau. He keeps me on top of things.
Yeah, I figured he would.
You're welcome.
If you could say your name and what district you're from, or county or city, whatever you want to do. But we do want to, everybody, members and staff, because we have some very good staff here in this committee.
Thank you, Chair. It's Ned Carroll. I'm from Plymouth. 42A is the district. A little bit of Maple Grove, too.
Mm-hmm. Steve Elkins. I represent the western half of Bloomington.
Hello, Anna Mahmoud, and I represent South Minneapolis, 62B.
Hi, I'm Representative Hewitt. I represent Rosemount, Apple Valley. I'm glad to be back on health. My points of interest will be emergency care.
Good afternoon, Tina Liebling from Rochester.
Hi there, Representative Christy Purcell from Northfield. Very interested in drinking water health for rural Minnesota.
Hello, Liz Ryer, Representative 52A, Egan and Burnsville.
Representative Robert Bierman, Apple Valley, and I'm the DFL lead on this.
Joe Harney, House Fiscal.
Jonathan Cotter, Committee Administrator.
Representative Jeff Backer, represent the western part that borders North Dakota, South Dakota, just south of Representative Keeler's area.
Kaylin Scorby is Committee Legislative Assistant.
Good afternoon, I'm Danny Nadeau. I represent Rogers, Dayton, and Champlain.
Good afternoon, I'm Representative Zeleznikar, and I have Hermantown, Proctor, Two Harbors, Rice Lake, Gary New Duluth, and 14 townships.
Representative Krista Knudsen, House District 5A, which is portions of Cass, Wadena, Hubbard, and Becker counties.
I'm Representative Scott Van Binsbergen. I'm from Montevideo, District 16A, and I represent Chippewa, Renville, half of Meeker, and a portion of Candiolai County.
Representative Aaron Rapinski, 26A, Winona County.
Representative Tom DePell, Cottage Grove, Hastings, Denmark Township, and Ninninger Township.
Representative Bernie Perryman, second term. I represent South St. Cloud, St. Augusta, Waite Park, and the east side of St. Joe and St. Joan Township.
I'm Rep. Don Gilman, and I am in District 17A.
Joe Schumacher, representing southwestern Minnesota.
Representative Mary Franson, House District 12B, representing portions of Douglas, Ottertail, and Pope County. Or not Ottertail County, that was my old one. Sorry, no. Jeff, that's yours. That's all yours. You're I meant to say way. Stearns, Pope, and Douglas.
Matt Eichinger, GOP Research.
Annie Mock, House Research.
I'm Elizabeth Clarkfist from House Research.
Jack Dockendorf, DFLCA.
Joe Durheim, DFL Research.
Representative Heather Keeler, District 4A, Moorhead. Representative Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager out of South Maplewood and Woodbury.
Thank you, members. Thank you. And we have Representative Bonner who just showed up, so you can introduce yourself quick.
Sorry about that. I'm trekking from another meeting in another building. Just before this, I'm State Representative Bonner from Maple Grove.
Thank you. Okay, so today we're going to have two agencies. So our first discussion is with the Minnesota Department of Health. We have Commissioner Cunningham here. And so come on down, kind of like The Price is Right, but we don't have any prizes. Just for roughly, because we have DHS also, so roughly two members, we're going to go up to about 150, 155 with the Commissioner Cunningham. And welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Brooke Cunningham, Commissioner of Health, Minnesota Department, for the record. Chair Backer, Vice Chair Nadeau, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here with you today to present MDH's priorities that are included in the governor's budget. For those of you all who do not know me, I joined MDH in 2022 as its inaugural Assistant Commissioner for Health Equity and became Commissioner January 2023. I am trained as a physician and a sociologist, and in my time at MDH, I have been impressed by the sheer scope of our work. Most of us know public health where it's infectious disease work. Certainly infectious disease is at the core of what we do, but as you all know, we do so much more than just infectious disease. At MDH, we work with communities to protect drinking water. We identify new substances when they get introduced into substances of abuse through our public health lab. We make sure pregnant women and infants get access to nutrition, breastfeeding support, lactation counseling, and health screening through our WIC program, and that infants are screened for their treatable conditions at birth in our newborn screening program. We support clinics to work on chronic disease. We support the 988 suicide line. We build community-based strategies for substance use prevention and recovery, and we regulate a number of entities through our health regulation division and our environmental health division. At MDH, our mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all communities. Minnesota's quality of life depends on thriving, vibrant communities, which means protecting people from the spread of infectious disease. It means clean water, strong schools, meaningful work, community connectedness, access to health care, and other important community support, so that it is easier for all of us in Minnesota to be our healthiest, no matter who we are or where we live. We in public health focus on the upstream social determinants of health. We want to prevent illness and injury before it starts. One way to think about us relative to our healthcare counterparts is healthcare tends to take care of one patient at a time at the individual level. We look at health and our solutions are targeted to the population level. And we collaborate with people in your communities. We collaborate with local public health departments. We collaborate with community-based organizations. We collaborate with tribal governments to keep each other informed of emerging health threats, to develop solutions together, to promote well-being and prevention. And we do this with the resources that you and your colleagues provide and with resources from the federal government. Just briefly, I want to give you all a sense of the resource divide in health budgets. This slide that's in you all's packet shows that we do all of this work with a relatively small investment in of the total health budget. This data shows the amount spent across the state by local public health departments. That's that little green box there relative to health care. So private, public payers, individuals, all were spending close to $67 billion per year on health care, paying for health care. But local public health departments only spend about $400 million across the state on their public health activities. And because funding has been both inadequate and inconsistent over time, our recent cost and capacity assessment found that public health services vary across the state. And certainly you all know that we are highly dependent both on state resources and on federal dollars to provide these services to Minnesotans. I will just note that 50% of MDH's funding for public health activities comes from the federal government. And when I talk to my colleagues in local public health, 36% of local public health departments' budgets for public health come from the federal government. What isn't shown here is that because Minnesota's population has grown over the last 20 years, the actual number of local public health professionals per capita has actually shrunk by 22%. So we've gone from about 59 FTEs in local public health departments per 100,000 people to 46 FTEs per 100,000 people. And these are the people working in your communities, keeping folk healthy. Timely public health response helps control disease spread. So fewer people get sick, there are fewer hospitalizations, and there are fewer deaths. And that just makes, that's a good return on investment. That makes good sense to keep people healthy and to bend what is always an escalating cost curve. And so while we talk about that curve, while we operate on tight budgets, what would it look like if there was greater health investment spent on public health? What would happen if we could devote more resources to address our policies, systems, our surroundings that shape the health of our communities instead of paying for expensive individual medical care after someone gets sick? We'd see a great return on investment, which is what this slide shows, for different data points. For every $1 invested in public health interventions, the median return was $14.3. Spending $35 million to promote physical activity, healthy foods, non-smoking meant Minnesotans save $365 million on obesity-related spending. And investing, of course, in health outside of hospital settings reduces death from all causes. We would have a tremendous societal impact, right? Because 1 ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So we come before you today knowing that we are facing challenging economic headwinds. Our approach to funding programs at MDH is responsible, measured, and honest about our needs. MDH has two cost proposals in the governor's budget, various fee proposals, and several budget-neutral proposals. In addition, we participate in requesting monies through the Clean Water Fund, monies that are requested and appropriated each biennium. This is a brief slide that's in you all's packet to just review the sources of the requests for MDH's budget package. You'll see general fund, SGSR, and healthcare access fund, as well as those clean water proposals. So let me move to our specific proposals. The main proposal in the general fund is investing in infectious disease prevention and response. This proposal seeks state funding to compensate for the loss of federal funding for prevention, early detection, and outbreak response to infectious disease in Minnesota. Again, we have typically in public health been underfunded. We welcome the COVID dollars both to respond to the pandemic and its urgencies, but also to build up some infrastructure in our infectious disease teams. And with coming federal reductions in COVID funding, we are looking at a loss of significant investments in our infectious disease unit. MDH worked closely with local public health partners and healthcare facilities to share data, to offer testing for disease, to provide information about how people can protect themselves, and to work together on strategies and solutions. You all know the infectious disease threats continue. I was recently on call with our federal partners about Ebola in Uganda. You all know about bird flu. You all know about tick and mosquito-borne illnesses. These incidences of infectious disease continue to emerge with ongoing historical threats, but also new ones. And clearly, our population is aging. We have increase in elderly Minnesotans. We have increase in folks who live in congregate care settings who are susceptible to disease. We have challenges in greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota with access to care. So again, investment in upstream solutions help prevent those downstream need for health care resources. I'm going to move quickly through our fee proposals. The story to these fee proposals is the same, right? So, and I will just tell you the story because they basically follow a pattern, right? Costs have increased. Personnel costs have increased, salaries have increased, covering related benefits for employees have increased, supplies have increased, technology, minute concerns, infrastructure costs, all of the costs over time have gone up. Complexity has also gone up over time. And clearly, without increasing fees, we will experience delays in serving communities with mandatory statutory inspections and with the technical assistance, because we like to be a partnering agency with the technical assistance and customer service to the folk that we serve. So we have, we are requesting a fee increase to our public water supply fee. This will help us to maintain capacity to maintain safe drinking water for the 80% of Minnesotans who rely on public water systems. Minnesota's MDH's Drinking Water Protection Program is projecting a reduction of $60 to $70 million in EPA funding over the next 3 years, and the last fee adjustment in this bucket was in 2019. I will say just a story about how we work with community water systems. One example is when there's a water main break that results in water pressure drop, and it creates the potential for pathogens to enter the water distribution systems. There are 1 to 3 incidents of this nature per month, and MDH staff provide 24/7 guidance to operators on required public notice and assist with following up sampling to ensure the water is safe for human consumption. So that is just one story of how we are on deck 24/7 to make sure clean water comes out of people's taps. Clearly, another percent of Minnesotans live off of wells, about 1/5 of Minnesotans, and MDH provides technical support to well contractors and property owners to ensure wells and borings are constructed properly and placed to ensure that they provide safe drinking water, that they are protected and sealed in ways that protect the groundwater and protect the environment. And so, and then there are additional challenges in the well space with growing technology, such as geothermal technology, and these fees, some fees and well management haven't changed since the 90s. Some adjustments were made in 2019. So we're asking again to make sure that we can maintain safe drinking water from wells as well. So the proposals on these four proposals on this slide request additional revenue from increased fees to account for the higher volume and complexity of the workload and assisted living and healthcare facilities and HMOs licensed and regulated by the Department of Health. So assisted living licensure, as I shared before, our state has a population that is aging. This has created greater demand for assisted living facilities, and MDH's role is to license and regulate those facilities. When these fees were set in 2019, we've had 25% more providers given the demand for assisted living come into the market, and as this is expected to grow as the population ages, and we need to be able that we can keep up our regulatory capacity. Clearly, it has outpaced what was envisioned in 2019. We also have a licensing and certification licensor implementation fee revenue, which covers the department's costs to process licenses, registrations, inspect facilities, conduct surveys, work with the state fire marshal, investigate complaints, issue deficiency orders, collect fines and penalties. There are a number of types of facilities under this bucket that are not assisted living, and they vary from the last time that their fees were increased from 2001 to 2015, right? And certainly 2001, costs have gone up. Certainly 2015, costs have gone up since that date. Engineering plan and review fees. The engineering plan review requests are increasing with the expansion and modernization of nursing homes, hospitals, and other healthcare entities. While the fees to conduct these have not increased since 2013, we need to make sure that our engineering teams have adequate resources so that they can oversee regulated facilities to ensure they meet appropriate health and safety standards. And again, the plans for these new facilities are ever more complex. The HMO fee structure, HMO, we do the initial licensure and the recertification. It's become more complex, as you all know, over the last 25 years, and we haven't had a fee increase in this bucket since 1999. New federal regulation has created additional requirements for monitoring federal compliance. new state laws, add new health coverage mandates nearly every session, and the corporate structures of healthcare continue to become more complex. Again, we would appreciate a fee increase to keep up and respond to the needs in this space. Moving on to some of our environmental health proposals. We need increase to food, pools, and lodging licensing fees. The number of establishments whose license are issued and the number required of inspections has increased significantly. We are our delegated agencies at the county level. We do food, pools, lodging, restaurants, mobile food units, all that serve fairs and festivals, and when you go out to get food, you want to make sure that that food is to consume is safe to eat. So we are asking for an increase to our food, pools, and lodging license fees. We did in 2022, we did an anonymous survey of Minnesota food workers, and 89% indicated the health department inspections were beneficial. Here's a quote from one of the survey respondents. I appreciate the work done by the health inspector and rely on guidance from MDH every day. I take my own responsibility as a food protection manager very seriously and appreciate support by the inspector to continually improve processes. We've also worked to improve our data systems. Here's a regulated party's response to those improvements. I like the new systems. Easy to use, and you folks are always fast, but this is really good. Nice work all. Again, we want to show up in a partnering fashion in a way that is efficient for the people that we serve in your communities, and these fees help us to maintain the added workload under the additional complexity. In addition to the increase in the fees, the request also includes a change in how the statewide hospitality fee is collected from establishments licensed by the 26 local delegated agencies, and we would like to modify the statute to require the collection of the hospitality fee by those delegated agencies at the same time of licensing each year. Radioactive materials. MDH is the licensor and regulator for most of the radioactive material used in the state through an agreement with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Radioactive materials are commonly used in the state in research, development, manufacturing facilities, evaluating soils, asphalt, concrete, and to evaluate welds on pipes and tanks. They are also used to diagnose and treat illnesses, including therapies such as gamma knife, radiation, brachytherapy, and therapeutic nuclear medicine. The legislator restructured and increased licensing fees in 2021, but the revenue generated has not kept up with current operating expenses for MDH oversight required under state law and the federal guidelines from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We also have a proposal for x-ray fee increases. We also regulate x-ray equipment, and this proposal increases fees for x-ray equipment and the base facility registration fee to protect the health and safety of occupational workers and the public from unnecessary exposure to ionizing radiation. The department is requesting a statutory change requiring the inspection of the x-ray equipment from a four-year time interval for all x-ray equipment to one that is risk-based and considers the incremental danger to human health based on radiation output. The last time these x-ray fees were adjusted was 2009. And finally, asbestos. The Asbestos Abatement Act contains a provision regarding intent. Because intent is difficult to establish, a person can disturb or remove asbestos and claim they did not intend to do so and circumvent permit fees. This limits the department's ability to enforce the statute, collect appropriate fees, and effectively protect public health. So we are requesting to modify Minnesota Statute Section 326.72 to strike the word intending. And this fee increase, the last fee increase was 2021. It will help us clarify the regulation, but it also will support current staffing through fees. Right now, our current fees allow us to inspect 10% of permitted projects in a timely fashion. However, the expectation is that we expect 30% in that timeline. And so, again, we want to be able to show up and meet those expectations promptly. We have a few budget neutral proposals. The first is to continue the early hearing detection and intervention advisory committee and to eliminate the committee sunset. Currently, it's set to end in 2025, and this is an important committee. We'd like to continue it. We'd like to shift the Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force to an advisory committee. That means it would not sunset, and this would allow us to reimburse committee members for their expenses and time spent serving Minnesota's children, youth, and family. And then last session, very important budget neutral proposal is last session funding for grants to local health departments for cannabis and substance misuse prevention was reduced by $3.67 million per fiscal year starting in fiscal year 2026. This proposal restores $2.5 million back to local and tribal public health departments for cannabis and substance misuse grants, and it does this by reducing appropriation for the substance use treatment recovery and prevention grants by $2.5 million, but there still remains $3 million in that bucket for that work. Additional budget neutral proposals include the American Indian Health Special Emphasis Grants. This would allow tribes to receive these grants without competition to support their community-driven health initiatives. Clearly, it's a high burden often on our tribal partners for competitive grants. Given these stubborn disparities, this removes the burdens for tribes to write a grant proposal in response to request for proposal ensures direct access to funding for the special emphasis grants for tribes, our 11 sovereign tribes. Community-based urban tribal organizations would still, community-based organizations would still compete for grants. The State Trauma Advisory Council, this reauthorizes the State Trauma Advisory Council for 10 more years. This council guides over 120 hospitals and 300 ambulance services to collaborate to deliver care for seriously injured patients, so to reduce their injuries and care for them in a timely manner. And then finally, the last budget neutral proposal supports firefighter health research by ensuring the completion of the PFAS biomonitoring and firefighters project to address exposures risks. Firefighters are at a much higher risk of PFAS entering their bodies due to the materials they work with to fight fires. And so MDH is working with experts to develop ways to do PFAS biomonitoring in firefighters. This project was fully funded, but we are asking for the ability to extend the timeline to complete this important work. Finally, our operations adjustment. This is the other proposal. This is the second of the proposals that I mentioned in the general fund. It also has some costs to the healthcare access fund. Clearly, operating increases are never fun to request, but the reality is just like all of those other entities that I talked about with costs going up due to salary costs, due to technology, going to supplies and other overhead, we see that too. So for MDH, this funding will cover expected growth in employee compensation and insurance and other operating costs, like fuel and utilities, IT, and legal services. And without additional resources to address these cost pressures, both in funding and in flexibility to manage internal budgets, services, of course, that we deliver will be impacted. And then there are a number of Clean Water Legacy Fund proposals. I will let you all review those slides at your convenience. Thank you so much for your consideration of all of these proposals. We welcome additional conversations. There are a number of folk subject matter experts in the room who also be happy to take any questions. I am up here with Autumn Baum, who is our Assistant Legislative Director. Brendan White from our Finance Department is also here. Please reach out to us anytime. We want to be your partners in protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. You're willing to take questions?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here with us today. Really appreciate you coming through and doing this walkthrough. I think it's essential for all of us to have this review and for especially new members who are a little less familiar. I've been on this committee for four terms. This is my fourth term now. And I learn so much every time I hear from Minnesota Department of Health or DHS talk about these programs. One thing I've learned in 4 years is Minnesota Department of Health is one of the best agencies we have in terms of bang for buck on resources that we put in and all the work that you do. I mean, I look at this sheaf of papers and I just think about all the other things you're doing at the same time, and I really appreciate the work. So this is by no means the full scope of it. Consistency of funding is critically important, and in these years of 10 years or 15 years or 30 years without an increase, it makes it difficult to do the job in the way that it needs to be done. So this, the terms of these increases, I think, are worth every penny of the investment, and I just want to, you know, tell you that I appreciate the work you're doing and that Minnesota Department of Health is so fundamental to the health of the state of Minnesota. In all the things you do, you reach every community, and if you go and talk to your local public health, I mean, and see the scope of the work they're doing, it's imperative. So I noted in the assisted living licensure implementation that increase of you know, people that are coming in the next decade or so, and the 25% more providers, I mean, you have to deal with all of those providers. And to do it at the same cost, anyone in business knows you can't do more for the same cost very long, and you've done a remarkable job with it. So I just wanted to comment on that. And especially appreciative of the public health, restoring the public health funding for the cannabis grants to local communities. I think substance use prevention starts in families and schools and local public health and the impact you can have on our cities and our communities, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, opioids. I mean, we need to put a bit of better focus on that. So thank you for the work and appreciate this overview.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Obviously, you're doing great work here keeping the public healthy and safe. That's, I think, a main job that we all have here at the Capitol. A couple of quick questions, and maybe you can get this back offline to me. The $400 million invested by the counties in this if you could get me a breakdown on that and show me what counties and where the money's coming from. And then secondly, I'm going to go real quick to my safe place, which is the State Trauma Advisory Council. Thank you. That's really, the target keeps moving on this system. We have more hospitals that have to shutter because they can't afford the ERs, so they turn into urgent care centers. That's happening across the state. But your division that you have there has done an excellent job with the target and keep moving it. I know they're really involved in the new department we put in place, so I really encourage the committee to dig into this more and learn exactly what that has done and what good they've done for the state. Like I said, that's a target that keeps moving even as of today, so thank you for asking for that to continue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I do have a couple of questions with the budget, like all of my colleagues here. We read all 243 pages of this. So I have a couple of questions. One of the things that you noted in here, that there was a zero impact on the food pools, the licensing fee. I mean, it's raising $5.4 million a year, and it's neutral because you're hiring FTEs to cover that. But I think it's a little bit I think it's a little bit misleading to say it doesn't have an impact. I mean, that has a huge impact. I mean, it's $5.5 million that, you know, that our lodging, our municipal pools, you know, our food trucks are going to have to bear. And I was wondering if you could spend some time talking about how that $5.4 million is going to actually be used specifically in that area.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Chair Backer, Representative Nadeau, thank you. Thank you so much for that question. There are a number of ways in which the increase in licensing will be spent. So 70% of that money will be an increase to license fees. 25% is an increase to the hospitality fee. There's another 38% increase to the registered environmental health specialist credential, and another increase in another another credential. So that is the breakdown of the fees, and I'm happy to have our members from our environmental health division work with you all about further information on what the increase in the $5.5 million go. Let me just also share with you a couple of other things that they have shared with me that will be impacted without this proposed fee increase. Inspections will not be able to be conducted per the statutory mandated frequencies because of the number of people in that space. Plan reviews for new construction or remodeling will take longer, which will delay the opening of new establishments and can result in increased costs by the owner if construction was started prior to the plan review being completed. I've also mentioned that we do or delegate inspections for non-brick and mortar establishments, such as those mobile food units that support food at fairs and festivals. There is no statutorily mandated inspection frequency, so without an increase, those units could fall to the back of the line, and certainly we like in Minnesota to enjoy our fairs and festivals. Data systems are really important, and data systems could become non-functional to support the functional upgrades to those systems. We want to move out of doing things by paper. This is 2024, and we don't want inspection reports being written by hand with no way of aggregating data on the inspections that staff are conducting should our data systems become non-functional. We also, again, want to work in a partnering way. So, again, the department does, across all types of our work, a lot of technical assistance. So their support for consultation training, and in addition to oversight of the delegated programs, and that could erode. So these are a lot of the core reasons why we are needing an increase in our fees. While we have seen the demand in terms of a number of entities opening, wanting to show up for them in a timely fashion, not wanting to add costs at the back end when plans don't go through or when we have to correct after entities have begun their work. Clearly, there's a lot under here in terms of food and beverage and lodging, but there's also public swimming pools, manufactured home parks, recreational camping areas and youth camps, and education services. So there's a lot here, and I'm sure should you have another specific question now, I could ask one of my team members for environmental health to speak to it, but also happy to follow up with more information with you afterwards.
Nadal, follow up?
Yeah, I have a couple more.
A couple more. Just to let members know, we do have three other people on the list. We're going to go for about 15 more minutes and then turn it over to DHS. So just keep that in mind, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I do, in light of the time, I'll connect with you offline on that and a couple of other things. But I will just ask one final question, and it's on the operational component of your budget. I want to say it's on page 21 of the governor's proposal. This is we're not adding any FTEs, but we're adding $2.4 million to your operational budget. And so can you just walk me through, and I mean, I've read this, so I understand what the kind of the defense is, but as I look at this, we're adding $2.4 million, no increased FTEs. I mean, that's basically $126,000 per FTE, and that's just, you know, basic math. Give me a better understanding of why we need to increase the agency operational budget this much.
Commissioner.
Chair Backer. Representative O, thank you for that question. Clearly, we are in the space as many other entities are. We've had We've had growth in employee compensation and insurance. We have growth in other operation costs. On the employer-paid healthcare side, we've got employer-paid healthcare. Healthcare costs keep going on. We've got FICA. We've got Medicare costs. We've got other salary and compensation-related costs just on the personnel side. But if you put the personnel to the side, we have operating costs like rent and leases and fuel and utilities and IT. Our minute costs are extremely high. Legal services, those costs continue to grow. So this funding is really not just for personnel coverage, although it certainly helps with that, but also to keep just our core operations functioning. And it is a relatively modest increase. The piece that you see from even from the Healthcare Access Fund, that modest increase is many of our programs and our health improvement bureau come from the Healthcare Access Fund, and to even implement those programs successfully, we need an increase in operations. So, again, happy again with anyone here, but to further follow up. But it is that we are sort of in the position as any other entity that has not had a lot of operational adjustments over the years. Although we appreciate what happened in 2023, it still is not enough to keep up with where we are in 2025.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
And in closing, and thank you, Commissioner. I am looking forward to working with you on some of these issues and getting a better understanding. I really appreciated in page four of this of the presentation, you talked about obesity and the investment that we're making there. And you know, it's interesting that when I read through the governor's recommendations, you know, equity and inclusion was riddled with it, which is great. But what was missing in there, I think, was some of those long-term things about obesity. I mean, 74% of Americans are obese. I mean, in 2022, $412 billion in America was spent on diabetes. 77% of our kids are not fit to serve in the military. 50% of our adolescents are obese and have diabetes, pre-diabetes or type 2. 18% of 18-year-olds have fatty liver disease. And these are all metabolic. And this is where I look at the, you know, the Minnesota Department of Health to really lead and help, you know, inform us. What are we doing? I mean, if we could literally ratchet back diabetes in Minnesota, we would save hundreds of millions of dollars. And I applaud the, you know, the Attorney General for, you know, driving down the cost of insulin. But we know that that's not going to solve the problem that we're facing today. And I don't mean to be nitpicky on the operational stuff, but we don't have a lot of money like we did last year. And I'm going to be looking really hard at trying to find those ways where we can actually make those investments. As you mentioned on slide four here, where it delivered $365 million in savings. And this is more than math. I want to see that $365 million in savings, you know, go towards our healthcare systems or wherever. We need to do more than math. And so I'm really looking forward to working with you this session and trying to find some solutions. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Zalesikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. My question is on the assisted living licensure implementation of the $4.1 million. The new violation level to identify actual harm in assisted living. My question is, assisted livings, to my understanding, were fined over $3 million during COVID just a few years ago. My question is, did the surveyors survey with the same rules and laws that existed before the pandemic and what we're using today? Or were the rules and laws modified to reflect the rules that were passed by the Minnesota Department of Health for COVID protocols during the pandemic?
Commissioner.
Chair Backer, Representative, thank you for that question. Clearly, we want to keep our elders and others who are living in assisted living safe with high standards of those facilities. In terms of that specific question around the modification of rules between the pandemic and now, let me have our health regulation team follow up with you and the committee with that answer in terms of what, if anything, has changed over the course of the last 5 years.
Any follow-up, Representative? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. That would be really helpful, I think, for this committee. My concern is the assisted livings are crawling out of a $3 million fine, and now we see $1.4 million in licensing fees. And many of these survey violations occurred during a pandemic. And my question is, if some of these situations were isolated from pandemic-related staffing, that the standards were set in this body, and they followed those rules, because we were in a pandemic, and so there were no third lines and fourth lines to pull like a hockey team to cover. We sent the National Guard to, I think, two nursing homes. So I'd love to know if there were modifications in the expectation, or if the expectation was to survey as if we were not in a pandemic, and fine accordingly as if there was no pandemic. Thank you.
Okay. We have four more reps before we get to DHS. So keep in mind, we got 10 minutes before we get to that. Next on deck is Representative Bonner.
Bonner.
I said that wrong. You are correct, Representative Bonner.
Okay.
Hey, I wanted to see if you were alert. Thank you.
Yeah. Make sure I know my own name. And certainly, if you need to get back to me on these answers, you know, we can always take my questions offline. But specifically, you mentioned around the well management fees and the increase that you were asking for to maintain that program. And that includes well certificate disclosures. And the stated goal of this is, of course, to address any budget shortfalls in support of staff. And when you say taking care of that budget, does that include increasing the fees for the counties who are doing that work and reporting it to MDH?
Commissioner.
Yes, thank you so much, Representative. So I will have to get back to you in terms of who the fee falls on, if it falls on the county specifically. I do know that my notes here are showing that in 2019, the legislature authorized a $0 fee for government agencies. And so for our county agencies, let me follow up with you because I don't see it readily in these notes.
Follow up, Representative Bonner?
Yes, and if that is the case and there is going to be an increase in the fee that goes to the county, yeah. Could you tell me what that is now versus what it is intended to be? And then lastly, and again, we can discuss this offline if you like, but I know that there's some conversation about counties actually trying to get away from doing that work and that there may be efficiencies in another way to actually collect that data and get it to MDH. I've been talking to them a little bit about that. And so it might be worth having a conversation about that in specific, because if there's a way that we could find a way to automate some of this process by getting it another way, it would take something off the county's plate, which they are telling me they would prefer. And they're even willing to give up the fee, by the way, to do that, which means more for you if necessary. But that could potentially help offset any costs for that automation. But that could be discussed separately.
Commissioner.
Chair Backer, I might ask someone from my environmental health program, since that is a basic yes or no, is it falling on counties? I don't know if Director Hogan is here and able to speak to that, just to get that for us in a timely way today.
Director Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Environmental Health Division Director at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I think to answer your question, those fees are not paid by the county. They are paid through the property transfer mechanisms. And we have been in discussions with the county recorders on automating that system and taking that burden off of their plates and getting that information directly into the state system.
Follow up, Representative Bonner.
Thank you. It might be worth having a conversation offline about that, but certainly that's good for me. I can move on so we can get to our other folks.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Just real quick, Commissioner, I think your department makes better use of data than any of the other departments that I work with, and I really especially enjoy working with the health economics team, you know, Stefan and Kristen and company. I'm hoping there's enough money in the budget for you to perhaps even make a few enhancements to some of this stuff as well, but that you'll at least tell me that you feel comfortable with the proposed level of funding in terms of being able to maintain your excellent level of analytical capabilities.
Commissioner.
Chair Backer, Representative, thank you for that point. Thank you for all members who have sort of complimented the hard work of the department. We do have a lot of very talented and dedicated staff who give their all to their work to care for Minnesotans. Clearly, our health economics team is one of the bright spots. Often, you know, you all consult that team. Clearly, we have new things going up, and part of my goal as commissioners has been to protect the work that we're doing, right? And so we don't currently see cuts in the governor's budget to our health policy program or our health regulation programs or to any of MDH's programs. We do need the fee increases to help us do our work better. I will just lift up for you, every division in our department, though, is funded by the federal government. And so as there are uncertainties at the national level when we are funded 50% by the federal government, surely the state cannot do that amount of backfill. And so that is of concern to me to simply maintain our work. And so I lift that up to committee members because of you all's influence both locally and with your colleagues at the federal level. We really rely heavily on monies both from the state but also from the feds. And so I am comfortable today. Nothing has changed today in what we're doing with our programs, but there's a lot of uncertainty out there.
Okay, we're going to just take questions from Representative Gilman and then leaving. So, and then we're going to jump to DHS. So Representative Gilman, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Backer. So Commissioner Cunningham, just one question and then a follow-up offline would be great. So just to kind of go back, piggyback on Rep. Zalesnikar's just licensing around long-term care, assisted livings. For example, I think it would be in your wheelhouse. CDC says 5 days if there's COVID positive patients, quarantine for 5 days, and then people that work there can come back to work if they're not symptomatic and they're doing well. How come the residents have to be quarantined in their room for 10 days? This is something that keeps kind of coming back to me right now, you know, that this is a concern, that residents are in their rooms for 10 days when indeed, like, you know, if there's an outbreak happening, if they're not symptomatic or they were even asymptomatic before they were, you know, tested positive. Is that something that your team is looking at, and is can that change or not? That's my question.
Commissioner Cunningham.
Chair Backer, Representative, thank you for that question. This is the first that I have been hearing about the quarantine for 10 days in long-term care or in assisted living. We have close partnerships with colleagues both in the assisted living space and the long-term care space. Let me follow up with our teams who work closely with them. Let's ask some questions to see what is happening. I certainly would be interested in where you see that happening and can follow up with that facility directly. So appreciate okay. that.
And just my last
follow-up.
Oh, thank follow you. Up. Thank you, Chair.
Yep, go ahead.
My last follow-up is if I could get some information as we're just talking about just maintaining the work that MDH does. When we go back to the operations budget, and you mentioned, you know, leasing, like renting space, IT, things like that. Of your facility, I mean, of your business space, the building right now, there were questions that were brought out to see how much of it is being utilized right now, how many people are still working remotely, things like that. That would be something that I'd be really looking at, and I'd love to know more about that right now, that we would need to increase spending in that area when potentially some of these buildings are sitting empty, is what we're hearing. So,
Commissioner Cunningham.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Chair Backer, Representative. Clearly, part of our ways that we sort of are judicious with funding is to look at space and to engage with space planning. Clearly, we have let go because of the hybrid work environment of at least one of our main leases in downtown St. Paul to save on that money. We have a 2,000 staffed sort of workforce, both split between St. Paul and our district offices. And so we are mindful of space planning, particularly in the hybrid work environment, as a means to save on costs.
Thank you. Representative Liebing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to help clear up what I think is a little confusion here on the committee, because Representative Zalesnikar was asking about assisted living licensure and the pandemic, but assisted living licensure in Minnesota didn't even begin until August of 2021. If I'm not mistaken, we were like the last state in the nation to even license assisted living. So I think members are confusing assisted living probably with nursing homes here in some of the questions. But, you know, so assisted living licensure that is in the budget here, it's not nursing homes, it's assisted living, if I understand properly, did not even begin until August of 2021. We tried to get it done earlier, but because of the pandemic, it was delayed, and it was really difficult to get the licensing started. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, any follow-up there?
Chair Backer, our representative, thank you for pointing that out. Clearly, there's an assisted living specific licensure increase that Representative Liebling is mentioning. And then there are a number of facilities under licensing and regulation. And I would have to look back at the total number of facilities there. So many of those, again, that between 2001 and 2015 that we license and regulate. And if long-term care is in that list, I'll be happy to let you know. But the specific assisted living licensure is for assisted living specifically.
Okay. Well, Commissioner, thank you for joining us today. I know you have a lot of work. You said you're going to work with your department to get our members here information that they've asked for, and you've been gracious to me since in this position. So thank you. And with that, we're only a few minutes behind. So members, the second item of business is the budget proposal presented from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And welcome to the committee, Interim Commissioner Gandhi. I hope I have that right. Okay, I get a point in horseshoes. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony and your staff here. And thank you for being here. Members will be open up just like before after their testimony for questions. And our goal is to be done by 2:45. So go ahead, Interim Commissioner. Yeah, we'll give you a second, a breath there to get the PowerPoint up.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Good afternoon, Chair Backer. My name is Shireen Gandhi, and I was appointed last week as temporary commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I have served DHS for the past 8 years as Deputy Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner, and Chief Compliance Officer. I came to DHS from the private sector in 2017, and before that I had had about 22 years in the healthcare sector, working for providers, hospitals, trade associations, surgical societies, primarily in the areas of quality of care, process improvement, and compliance. A significant portion of my career has focused on those areas, and at DHS I've been focused operationally on similar items. At DHS I've led the creation of a compliance oversight structure, and I continue to champion process improvement efforts. And as much as we've accomplished to date, continuous process improvement is a continuous improvement effort. We are never done. There is always more to do, and that is why we approach it with a continuous improvement mindset. I look forward to working with all of you in the coming weeks, perhaps months, as temporary commissioner until a permanent commissioner is named. So at DHS, our mission is that in collaboration with community and partners, we support people to thrive in community and live their healthiest, fullest lives. We have been on a journey the past couple years to transition DHS into three thriving agencies. DHS last summer, we transitioned DCYF into its own agency, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And this summer, Direct Care and Treatment will transition into its own agency. At DHS, we'll focus on physical, behavioral health, long-term care services, including the state's Medicaid program, housing, and services for seniors and people with disabilities. At DHS, the way that we'll be organized going forward following the transition is we will have separate administrations for aging and disability services, behavioral health, health care, homelessness, housing, and support services, the Office of Inspector General, and then our central office operations functions. At DHS, we have a good track record of working with the legislature and the governor's office to have strong outcomes for the people of Minnesota. We are number one nationally in services for older adults and people with disabilities, providing quality services and supports for the older adults and people with disabilities according to several different measures from ARP, the Commonwealth Fund, and the SCAN Foundation. We are fifth nationally in child well-being for providing high-quality supports for mental health in the appropriate setting, including schools. And that came from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And we're 11th nationally for providing healthcare access and quality outcomes, keeping more than 1.3 million people in Minnesota covered by public health insurance, including 42% of children. And that comes from the Commonwealth Fund in 2023. And so now, with those outcomes in mind, I'd like to have Elise walk the committee through the budget for DHS for this session.
Go ahead, Director.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members of the committee. Again, I'm Elise Bailey, the Budget Director of the Department of Human Services. I'm going to go over a few kind of basic statistics on our budget, and then I'll hand it off to Assistant Commissioner Conley to go over some of the specific proposals in our budget, in the governor's budget this year. So slide number six just kind of gives a brief snapshot of what our budget is in fiscal year 26 and the number of people that are impacted across the state by our program. So DHS directly impacts more than a quarter of all Minnesotans. Our programs impact 45% of all kids in Minnesota, 29% of adults and parents, 17% of older adults, and 28% of all people with disabilities across the state. So the magnitude of the decisions in this committee are great, and I just wanted to kind of center that. We have a budget in 26 of about $24 billion, and more than half of that comes from the federal government, about 54%. We also, of course, $9.4 billion comes from the general fund, and about $1 billion comes from the healthcare access fund. Slide seven goes over just another brief snapshot of the number of people we serve per month in each of the different programs. I'll just highlight the programs that are relevant to this committee's jurisdiction. So about 1.3 million Medicaid enrollees in fiscal year 24 received health care. About 102,000 Minnesota Care enrollees. And within that Medicaid number, the 1.3, about 837,000 people were families with kids. So as I mentioned, our budget comes mostly from, or 54% of our budget is from the federal funds. This slide just gives a snapshot of the last few years on how our budget has grown and then gone down over time. And I'll give a few details on why that is on the next slide. So slide 9 is the last 10 years or so. And there's some dynamics in here that I'd like to point out. So, of course, in 21, that's when we first started getting more funding from the federal government and the legislature around responding to the COVID-19 crisis. At that time, we were instructed in order to receive that additional money from the feds under the Medicaid program that folks had to be continually enrolled. And so throughout that period of time, the number of people that we served on our programs grew until the unwinding process began, which is when the federal emergency ended and about halfway through fiscal year 24. And then we started re-enrolling people, essentially ensuring that going forward, people met the eligibility requirements for the healthcare programs as required by the federal government. So that's where you'll see the dip to where we are today. Another component of this is, of course, the agency split that Commissioner mentioned. So that began in fiscal year 25, the year that we're in, and will end in fiscal year 26. And so you'll see in the green line, that is what our budget would have been if those parts of our budget had never been part of DHS. So you can get an apples to apples comparison. So what do we spend our budget on? In fiscal year 26, about 89% of our budget is on the medical assistance program. So a huge chunk of the budget. 6% of our budget is on other forecasted programs. So within here, we have Minnesota Care, Housing Support, General Assistance, and the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program, along with the Behavioral Health Fund. 3% of our budget is spent on grant programs. So this is both state and federal funds. And then just 2% is spent on operations. So that's staffing and all our IT costs. Slide 11 goes over just a snapshot of the medical assistance program. So on average, we get a federal match of about 54%, but that varies based on the service and the population that we're serving. 42% of all kids across the state are covered by Medicaid. And in fiscal year 24, we were just shy of about $19 billion in expenditures. This slide is kind of an interesting depiction across the state of how many people, of the total population, how many people receive health care through medical assistance. So it varies a little bit. The northwest corner is probably the biggest percentage of about 28.1% of the population receiving MA, with the lowest percentage in the central part of the, or no. The south, sorry, southeast part of the state at 22.8%. The other graph shows kids. So, again, the northwest corner of the state, over 50% of the kids in that area receive medical assistance. In fiscal year 26, our total budget on MA will be about $21.6 billion of all funds. And this slide just kind of goes over the differences in the eligibility categories and the services we're providing. So about $10 billion or 46% of that spending is in long-term care facilities, so nursing homes and the long-term care waivers and home care. And then the remainder of the program is spent on the basic care areas, to which I understand is the jurisdiction of this committee. So elderly and disabled basic care of about 21% of the budget, families with children about 20% of the MA budget, and adults without kids are about 13% of the total budget of all funds. Slide 14 goes over the federal match that we generally get
for the different populations that I just went over. So as you can see, one takeaway here is while we may have a bigger budget for MA adults without kids, it's a 90% federal match. So any changes you're making to that program, it will really depend on what the savings or costs would be in this committee, given that the federal match is different than other areas of the MA budget. Okay, with that, I'm going to go into the governor's budget this year. So Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, in the DHS health jurisdiction budget, it's really centered around strengthening our program integrity of our programs, ensuring access to needed services by mitigating any potential fiscal cliffs, curbing areas where we have growth in spending, and then increasing our operational effectiveness. In this jurisdiction, the slide just goes over the totals of about, $575 million in savings across the 4 years. These are the proposals that we'll go over today in this committee, and I'll dive right in. So the first proposal we'll review is increasing the HMO, or the Health Maintenance Organization, surcharge. So currently, the surcharge in current law is 0.6% of the total premium revenue for HMOs, and this budget will increase it to 1.25%. This budget also includes increasing the healthcare access fund share of medical assistance. So MA is financed primarily through federal and state funds. While MA spending is forecasted, the healthcare access fund share is set by the legislature, leaving the remaining state share to be paid by the general fund. So this essentially increases the healthcare access fund appropriation for medical assistance by $25 million. And there's a corresponding decrease in general fund appropriations for MA. With that, I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Conley to go over the rest of the proposals.
Go ahead, Assistant Commissioner Conley.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, members of the committee. So a few of the governor's and lieutenant governor's specific proposals related to healthcare within DHS. The first is to extend access to audio-only telehealth services. And just a couple of notes of background here. So access to audio-only telehealth within MA was first authorized by the legislature in 2021 during the public health emergency. And with that, there was a direction for the department to work with the Department of Health to complete a study to look at the impact of this and make recommendations about extending access to audio-only telehealth. That study was completed in the fall of 2024, and so we are coming back. The governor and lieutenant governor are recommending extending access to audio-only telehealth. That access would have sunset on July 1st of this year, or will, without this action. And the proposal is to extend access for another 2 years until July 1st, 2027. So that is the first proposal today. I would note, before moving on to the next one, too, sorry about that. I think the particular benefit of extending access to audio-only telehealth is that folks who have particular kind of transportation needs or don't have the technology to access healthcare benefit disproportionately from this service, and particularly, we should add, in greater Minnesota. Thank you. The second proposal today is about the sunset of the Drug Formulary Committee. And so this is the committee of professionals that we assemble to make recommendations about what drugs are on our preferred drug list, or PDL. A couple of important things to note about this, in addition to just receiving kind of expert and professional input about the preferred drug list, and also the opportunity for regular public comment about the drugs included there, is that this is the primary means that we use to gain additional supplemental rebates for prescription drugs in the Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance programs. So again, maintaining this list with that professional input is really essential to gaining that additional revenue in terms of supplemental drug rebates. And so we are recommending for an extension of the Drug Formulary Committee to prevent its sunset on June 30th, 2027. The next proposal is related to the pharmacy carve-out. Currently, pharmacy is carved into managed care. So when we speak of carving in or carving out, that customarily refers to having things delivered through managed care contracts, or MCOs, within Minnesota healthcare programs. This particular proposal recommends a carve-out of prescription drugs within the medical assistance program specifically, and it results in a savings for a couple of different reasons. The first is, of course, the removal of the administrative cost of managed care plans administering this benefit, and that's at roughly the rate of $2 per member per month. In addition, though, the vast majority of the savings here achieved through the proposal would be through 340B drug pricing program savings. So currently, providers, some safety net providers, principally hospitals, do receive 340B revenue as a discount by participating in that program. The condition of that, though, is that then the state does not access prescription drug rebate revenue for those drugs if they're accessed through the 340B program. So by carving pharmacy out of managed care, the state then can access those revenues through the Medicaid prescription drug rebate program. And we would access roughly 30% savings on those drugs that are currently accessed by providers through 340B. And then, of course, the next one here is related to the elimination of chiropractic care. And again, the primary driver here, as with all of the savings proposals, is really a structural imbalance in the budget. And so that is the primary driver of the proposal to eliminate the chiropractic benefit within within MA. And then the next is the administration of the non-emergency medical transportation benefit, or NEMT, through a single administrator. So in this case, we would seek, as you know, Minnesota healthcare programs, to have a single administrator take on this benefit at an assumed or estimated cost of $3 per member per month. And of course, this allows us to provide more direct regulation of the benefit, more uniform access to services. The vendor would negotiate rates with individual providers and coordinate services. So again, this is improved visibility and oversight from the program perspective, in addition to the cost savings that you see indicated here on the slide. And I believe there's one left here that is a more technical proposal related to the rate methodology for federally qualified health centers. And this really just is a clarification in statute of how rates or encounter rates for federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs, get calculated when two FQHCs merge, or when one kind of purchases or takes over ownership of another. And so this is just sort of formalizing in statute how that is calculated, and it takes into account the full cost of both of those entities and the number of visits that they use to calculate that rate. So just a technical clarification there. And I believe that is the final proposal.
Okay, members, questions? We have Representative Killer, you're first on deck.
Thank you, Chair. So I have two questions. The first, I think, was Ms. Bailey. Good job. We talked about on page 12 of the handouts. So I'm in Moorhead. I serve on the west side, and I see that my region in the MA enrollment is 50% are youth. So I just want to make sure I understand the data. So this is saying that 50% of the kids in this region are on MA?
Go ahead.
Chairback,
Director.
Representative, that is correct. 50.5% of all children living in that region receive health care through MA.
Representative Killer, follow up.
Sure. Thanks, Chair. So it just makes me kind of want to dig in a little bit more. We can follow up about it. But if you look at down south, probably more your neck of the woods, they're 46%. And so if you cut the state in half, it's just making me wonder what on the west side is happening of our state that's making a high percent of our kids need access to this. So I kind of would like a breakdown of what's the age breakdown, and then what's the severity of like the services we're providing. Are these high severity youth with like medical concerns that we're paying high rates out? Is it our babies? I just kind of want a little bit of a breakdown. That's the first kind of follow-up, please. And then my second question is more around the telehealth question, which I think, Assistant Commissioner, you chatted about. So it's a pretty big sticker price when we look at the extension. I understand that, but sitting on the border, one thing that we have had a lot of issues with is access to
our mental health services, understanding that people just can't travel anywhere and then call in to have mental health services because we have to have a response system. But would really like some follow-up on when we say we need it for Greater Minnesota, is it because we need telehealth options because we don't have the professional capacity to provide those services within geographic region? I think that's kind of a different question on needing access to services versus we have them in our backyard, you know, and we just don't want to utilize them and we're utilizing telehealth. So those are two different sort of concerns that I'd like to have some follow-up on because in rural Minnesota, we just don't have the same professional depth that we have in the metro. And so if we're going to continue ongoing telehealth, I think at some point we need to have a breakdown of which counties are utilizing this, because they don't have those providers within region, you know, they're driving 2 to 3 hours one way for an appointment. So some follow-up on that would be great.
Director Bailey, comment?
Chair Becker, Representative, yes, we can follow up with you definitely on that. I know that the Department of Health has an extensive report on access and efficacy of telehealth, so we can also send you that, but definitely would be happy to follow up.
Yeah, I would agree with Representative Keeler. We, on the western part of Minnesota, we do not have the same resources as the metro area. And actually, all my district's in that upper 50.5, so you and I are in the same boat. So a lot of care, but we want to make sure they get the right care. So with that, we are to Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, Mr. Conley. Ms. Bailey, for being here today. It's always astounded me the numbers of people that are served by DHS programs, especially in the medical assistance program, and how, you know, this impacts so many people across the state with so many different conditions and age. And I want to just say that I'm not sleeping very well right now with what's happening in Washington and knowing the level of support that the federal government supplies to Minnesota to do this work. So I guess my question is, how are you all sleeping? And, you know, we've been in touch a little bit about this as we go. Nobody really knows how this is going to fall, but it's really as we think about the state budget and what we're up against, this is a really serious moment. So we just appreciate, you know, how you're doing and thinking about this. And then I have one question after that, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I don't know who wants to take that. Director Bailey, go ahead.
Chair Becker, Representative. I won't comment on how well we're sleeping. But I would say that our approach is pretty comprehensive. We've decided to pull together a group of, you know, leaders in our agency and to be well prepared for anything that comes down the pike. Now, at this point in time, we don't have any stoppages in payment. There was a brief blip where we couldn't access federal funding. But at this point, we don't have any that to our knowledge that it has happened yet. So we have developed a group of leaders at our agency that will be ready and available to assess when we do have bills going through Congress or other executive orders that do impact the funding of our agency. We do rely on federal funding quite a bit. 54% of our funding is from the federal government, and any given change could impact our budget by magnitudes. And so we are ready and we are prepared to assess any changes and definitely work with you as those occur.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to put that on the table for the committee's knowledge and to think about that. So going from a big question like that to a very focused question, I'm wondering about the Drug Formulary Committee. I just wanted to check the committees formed by individuals who are licensed and actively participating healthcare providers. And I was learning the other day that these members are not able to comment or to provide input for certain drugs and that they were like there's a conflict of interest or something to that effect. And I just wanted to understand what their requirements or restrictions are if you are serving on that committee. Are there times you have to step away from participation when certain products come up, or are they able to use their professional, their knowledge to contribute? And if you want to get back to me, that's fine too.
Director Bailey.
Chair Backer, Representative, we'll get back to you on that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Very informative. I got to tell you, I have reservations over bringing a broker back to special trans. We went down this route before. I was actually involved with the industry at that time. This isn't as simple as pushing an app on your phone and expect somebody that has a capability of moving a patient or moving somebody around. And we had terrible horror stories. This committee actually at that time heard those stories, and I'm sure they'd bring them back to us if that was the case. And this was 10 years ago when we had a broker in this space. And I understand all over the country this is a problem. This isn't just Minnesota that's having this issue. It also involves throughput and flow of our hospital systems. If they can't move that patient off the floor, then they're backed up, the ER's backed up. I think we have to proceed very carefully with this. I think the broker has to take on some liabilities to make sure the patient actually gets from A to B. Like I said, this isn't a simple Uber app. We're actually working with real people that have challenges. They're going by this service because of that. So I'm reluctantly supportive. And I know it's always about the money that's transacted and how much they get paid and stuff, but I want us to be very careful with this. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any comment? Okay, cool. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifiers here. I'm actually very, very concerned that we are cutting health care for lower income individuals by going after chiropractic care. There's a lot of health benefits for chiropractic care, and I'm so interested in why we're chopping that benefit off instead of maybe rooting out some waste, fraud, and abuse in the Department of Human Services. Instead, it seems that the energy, from looking at a email that's been floating around, that DHS is more interested in chasing after emails from employees that may not say something nice about a certain deputy assistant commissioner. This assistant commissioner went to his buddies at the, looks like, what did he say, the buddies at the intelligence research with the Army to give them the IP addresses of individuals who had maybe not kind things to say about a commissioner. I find that a waste of taxpayer dollars, and perhaps the Department of Human Services could do a better job of taking care of our tax dollars instead of going after health care for poor people. And then let's talk about the DCYF, the spinoff. We were told that it was going to be cost neutral, if I recall, members, that it wasn't going to be extra dollars. But my intel from inside says that it's costing the taxpayers a lot more and is a growing state government, making it harder to fight fraud. And then also, to save money, that the Walz administration would like to put Minnesota citizens' data at risk, moving to a commercial cloud instead of putting the data in a government cloud. And I'm concerned about that too. And I'm just curious to know why we aren't going after fraud and instead attacking healthcare for poor people and employees within the Department of Human Services.
Assistant Commissioner or Director.
Thank you, Chair Backer, Representative Franson. DHS has a strong track record of going after fraud, of working to prevent fraud and to prosecute fraud, and more can be done. The governor's come forward with a package to strengthen our controls, strengthen our ability to use new tools to detect fraud and stop it. And I would be happy to meet with you offline to discuss any specifics that you have that involve individual DHS employees. I don't want to discuss that in public, but happy to meet with you and discuss that within the framework of our privacy rules. And if you would like to meet, if you would like to work with me further on that through the OLA so that we can have protections for the employees, I would be happy to do that as well. But absolutely, fraud remains an important topic. It is something that takes away money from people that we are trying to serve. We are trying to get food to children and families, health care to families. You saw the numbers on the percentage of families and children that we are serving across the state of Minnesota. And it is absolutely essential that we continue to up our game and get the bad actors out of healthcare, out of trying to take money from the citizens of Minnesota. We have to be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars, and we're absolutely here to partner with you on it and to work together to up our game wherever we can.
Follow-up, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. You know, I guess I'm just kind of a realist in a way that I've been here long enough that I hear the same song and dance. I've done the tango a few times on the waste, fraud, and abuse with DHS, and I was around for after the $100 million fraud story broke, and we were told, oh, money's not going overseas. That employee was, he was just a bad, disgruntled employee, but yet we still have the fraud cases, even though Mr. Stillman was ixnayed from the department and his reputation was ruined. And we had Operation Swiss Watch. During that time, there was another operation something or other, and that was supposed to cut out the fraud. I was on the Early Childhood Committee during that time, and we were assured fraud is going to stop. We had amendments and bills to bring up to put some accountability on the department. They were all voted down, told, oh, we got a handle on fraud, and yet I think we know that there is a major problem that this administration needs to recognize and not just come with a proposal just because the public is now demanding it. They were demanding it before. It's just unfortunate, I suppose, for some people that it made it to a national scene and it was embarrassing. So now we actually do have to do something, but thank you.
Any comment on that or no?
Chair Backer, Representative Franson, I would say that DHS, Office of Inspector General, does have a strong track record of tackling fraud. About 80% of the cases that you hear from the Attorney General's office, from the FBI, from HHS OIG, started with DHS investigations and handing that over to the parties that can prosecute.
We're going to go to, thank you, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Backer. My question is for Mr. Connolly. So you said there'd be about a 30% savings going in rebates to the state, 30 or 34, I can't remember. So carving out the drugs from the managed care plans. So what happens to the other 70%? That's my question.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm sorry. We were working on a list here. Go ahead.
Sure.
State Commissioner Cotney, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So essentially, that's the 30% reduction in the price that we would pay as a state for those drugs, given that we would be receiving prescription drug rebate revenue from the federal Medicaid program. So the other 70% of the cost we would be paying, or the program would be paying through the fee-for-service program through the carve-out. So that would still be the rate that we would pay for the drug. But the savings of 30% is what we're estimating if we move these drugs from managed care and then seek the rebate revenue through the drug rebate program.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, that'll be a fun one to dive into more another time. I just have one more question on page 18, Chair Backer. So just seeing the increase, the surcharge, the HMO surcharge increase go from 0.6 to 1.25. Isn't there also going to be, so that's a pretty big hike there, but won't there also be adding a fee for HMOs to review the licenses on top of that? Won't there be added fee on top of that? That's my question.
Assistant Commissioner, or whichever you
think. Chair Backer, Representative Gilmer, not in DHS's budget book. I'm not sure if MDH is in charge of that or other agencies are, but not under our purview, so I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative?
That would be just, I'd just love to know, just with a lot of the fee increases, that's another thing that I'd be curious to know where that would be coming from. Thank you. Thanks.
Then we go to Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple things here. First of all, I think that this budget really shows how hard it really is to cut the budget without hurting people. You pretty much, I mean, this is a big budget, and if you want to make significant cuts to it, it's really hard. And so, yeah, there are some things in here that probably would hurt some folks. And I commend the governor and your staff for just putting it on the table. It's really hard, right? So I just want to point out a couple things, and I do have a question also. But, you know, the slide you've given us on page 13 here of our handout where it talks about, you know, how much of the budget is going to which populations. One of my predecessors, and, you know, there are a lot of new people on the committee here, and this is complicated stuff. We know that. It's really hard to get your head around some of this, especially when you come in new, as I did some time ago without any background in it. But one of my predecessors always used to say the average person on medical assistance is an 80-year-old woman in a nursing home. And I think that still holds here, and I just want to put that in front of people because when we think about who are we supporting here, and we've heard some pretty astounding numbers like how many children are on MA and all of that, but the money, where the money's going is really to elderly people in nursing homes. So I hope that the feds don't just come in and yank away their support because that's going to mean nursing home closures. Primarily, I mean, it's going to mean a lot of pain for a lot of people, but that's a big one because that's where a lot of our money's going, a lot of where the federal money's going. The other thing, I also wanted to bring up the pharmacy carve-out, and this is something I've worked on quite a bit, and I think this more maybe, and please tell me if this is wrong, but I think the maybe more simple way of explaining this is that when we run our pharmacy through the managed care organizations, the state is really paying full price for the medications. They're getting some savings. Other entities are getting some savings from it, but they're selling it to the state at full price. If we stop doing that, the state is able to get the discounted price for those medications instead of buying it through the MCOs, managed care organizations, at full price. It's a really rough explanation, but is that way off in any way, Mr. Connolly?
Assistant Commissioner Connolly.
Chair, Representative, I think that is an accurate characterization.
Okay, so thank you. So, Mr. Chair,
if I
could then. So my question to you, Mr. Connolly, in this proposal, why are you only doing this in MA? Why not also in Minnesota Care? My understanding is Minnesota Care is not included here. And why is that?
Assistant Commissioner, go ahead.
Chair, thank you, Representative. It's a good question. So, in essence, the savings would only be achieved through MA because that's where the prescription drug rebate revenue would come. So there wouldn't be savings through a carve-out through Minnesota Care. Moreover, there are federal regulations that govern the delivery of Minnesota Care as a basic health program through managed care organizations. So that's another issue that affects Minnesota Care that's unique to that program.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that reminder. Okay, that makes sense. So, all right. Well, that's, I think, you know, just to say, the pharmacy carve out, while, again, this isn't pain-free, none of this is pain-free, it seems to me that is one place where we can get savings, which we have to find, and actually make improvements for the population we serve at the same time. So thank you for putting that in the budget.
Representative, I'm just to let you know, we have three on deck. We have about 7 to 8 minutes, and the next on deck is Representative Bonner.
All right.
Thank you. I'll try to be fast. I did just have a question. You had mentioned during the unwinding that we can see on, I believe it's page 9, that our costs did go down substantially after the unwinding. But I know that there's folks that clearly fell through the cracks in that did not get their applications processed in time. And I'm assuming that many of those folks are now having to go back and reapply. And I know that because my brother is one of those individuals who had all his paperwork in on time. Mom handed it to the clerk at the front desk. And then they later told him that he did not submit his paperwork in time after she specifically asked them to stamp the paperwork with the date and time. So I know he had to go reapply and do all the steps to get back on. So I guess my question is, we know that there are other people like that who fell through the cracks. And so I know that while it dipped down significantly, I'm assuming that there's a portion of those folks who got kicked off that really were not supposed to get kicked off. So do we have any idea how that's impacting what we're looking at in terms of forecasting for the budget going forward? And do we feel like some of that flux has settled down? Do we think that it might increase a little bit in terms of what we're seeing, or just kind of getting a lay of the land at how stable do you think those numbers and projections are, and what do you see in that space?
Whoever wants to tackle that.
Chair Becker, Representative Bonner, that's a great question. I wish I had my November forecast notes with me. But I do think from our forecasting perspective, we think it has settled down. We do anticipate a bit of an uptick from the lowest point, but we do think our projections are pretty stable at this point. But I can get you numbers on percentage of people dropped and percent of folks that are on. We are ending up at a level that is higher than prior to the pandemic.
Okay. Follow up, Representative.
Very briefly, and we could, I'll just say this and let it be. But I did want to make sure, and I won't go too far into this because we don't have enough time, but I did just want to say when we talk about specifically cloud storage that there's significant efficiencies to be gained by going with a vendor and by the state not having to actually own that equipment, maintain it, to do all of those things. I believe it was Representative Nash who actually had the bill to push this direction, and he could speak at great length on the benefits of doing that and what that is. But that said, it's important to note that is a storage container and that anyone that accesses that information has to go through rigorous checks and balances in order to get access to that. Even partitions within, say, a warehouse space or a cloud space in order to get access to specific types of data. So that's very, very specific and very much very different than what's happening at the federal level right now, where we see that folks are busting down the doors and taking down the walls and accessing all kinds of data that they shouldn't. So I just want to be, as the IT person, I felt like I needed to say that. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair Backer. With the shortness of time, I'll pass. And I'll take my questions at some other time.
Okay, thank you. And then finally, Representative Zalissa Carr.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. And I would like to just comment on some of the comments that have been made on the specific uniform administration on non-emergency medical transportation. While I concur with you that it's important because 70% of the ambulance runs are non-emergency, I have great concern on this pathway of this format and would love to see more presentation to this committee following the EMS task force and the aging task force on how the single administrator model would change the outcomes, especially for greater Minnesota. And so that, and the other thing is just the actual data that you have that led you to the elimination of chiropractic services, what the thought process is, because that is a significant medical treatment that many are using for pain management and many services that reach out to me. So I'd just like to know your thinking on what the options are going to be for that clientele, and thank you.
Intern Commissioner Gandhi or whoever wants to handle that question.
Chair Backer, Representative, we don't have policy rationale for eliminating the chiropractic benefit. It was simply reducing costs. So there's certain services under the Medicaid program that are required and certain ones that are optional. And that service happens to be optional, so it's not required by the federal government.
Follow-up, Representative.
So are there other items that are not essential besides chiropractic?
Director Bailey.
Chair Backer, I don't know if you have them memorized, but I have a few off the top of my head. Okay. Yes, things like occupational therapy, physical therapy, things that you might think should be in an insurance benefit, but are technically optional. But we can get you the full list.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, members, thank you. We have 1 minute to spare, so there being no further business before the committee, our next meeting will be this Wednesday, February 12th from 1 to 2:45 at the same location, Capitol 120. Again, thank you, members. We are adjourned.